يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series taking a close look at the Middle East, North Africa region. Hello and welcome to Middle East Analysis. Now, it's been pretty much a month since we've last had our studio guest, Dr. Harry Hagopian, in the studio, the Bishop's consultant on the Middle East, North Africa region. And unless you've been hidden away, obviously you'll realise that probably the two biggest stories in the region at the moment are the two humanitarian disasters that are Gaza and Mosul. Now, we'll be talking about those and much more, actually, with Dr. Harry Hagopian. Now, Harry, I know you've been here, there and everywhere. How are you doing?
Hello, I'm fine, James. It's interesting you say the two humanitarian stories. You are right. They are the two key ones that have grabbed the headlines as far as the Middle East, North Africa goes. However, they've also eclipsed other stories that have been happening in the region, which are equally serious for the people of those countries too.
Yeah, very alarming, a lot of the stuff that we've even been talking about off mic. That we'll,
absolutely, we'll and in us. A sense, because we're not news and we're more analysis, then we can allow ourselves to sort of draw back and look at the picture broadly rather than be there as if we are tweeting breaking news all the time, which we are not.
No, we're not. But what we're going to do is we are going to presume some knowledge here, because it's not day one of the offensive into Gaza.
8th of July. So it's over 3 weeks that the war and the offensive on Gaza has been taking place. So I'm sure most of our listeners will know the general parameters.
We can say, you know, round about 1,360 Palestinians dead, a great many civilians, round about 60 Israelis killed as well. There have been rockets into Israel, illegal tunnels. There's been, obviously, the Operation Protective Edge offensive. Yesterday, with the bombing of a refugee facility at a school, I mean, obviously, we were appalled at that. But we also heard that potentially there were Hamas rockets coming from there into Israel. So I don't really know where to start. Clearly, I want to be even-handed about this. Clearly, I want to be up to date as we can be. Where do we start, Harry?
James, it's a very difficult situation. As you well know, I earned my political stripes with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict rather than the broader MENA region. The MENA region was more of an add-on that took place 4 or 5 years ago with what was then called inappropriately the Arab Spring. But in all those years that go back to the 1990s and the Oslo years, I've always found exactly the same problem that you just underlined now, which is how can you be even-handed? And how can you express a balanced view? Because no matter what you say, in an atmosphere that is so polarized between Israelis and Palestinians, no matter what you say can be seen as if you are taking sides. And that is the difficulty. And that is a difficulty I've had since the second track negotiations during the Oslo years, all the way leading up to what is happening today with Gaza. But when I look at what is happening in Gaza today, I divest the political dimension of this war from the humanitarian dimension. And there are many issues that you sort of clumped together rather quickly, because first we don't have the time and it's already déjà vu in the sense that it's been running for over 3 weeks. The tunnels, the rockets lobbed at Israeli sites, the counterattacks and random shelling, all these things are part and parcel of what we see today. The abduction of the three Israeli teenagers, the burning and death of the Palestinian as a countermeasure. All this has actually ramped up the tensions between Palestinians and Israelis. But I will just give you a couple of statistics, and I think that our listeners are clever enough, informed enough, and faith-centered enough to take those statistics and facts and then draw their own conclusions. I don't want to draw those conclusions for them. Let's take Gaza. Gaza is a small strip of land which is no more than 360 kilometers square. That's 200 square miles. It's a strip that houses roughly 1.8 million Palestinians. The majority of those Palestinians are refugees or offspring of refugees from either the 1948 or the 1967 wars. These are people who are living in that narrow strip of land which has been cordoned off. So people call it an open prison, people call it a walled prison, people call it a concrete cage. A lot of people call it a lot of things. And in a sense, when you put 1.8 million people in a container, lock that container and throw the key away, so much so that only you, if you are generous enough, can open that container or close it, no wonder that some of those people freak out. And freaking out could either be losing your sanity, or getting so angry that you're becoming irrational, or it could be very close to colonizing another people. All this is happening in Gaza. Today, as we speak in Gaza, you just gave me some statistics and our listeners heard that. The 1,000 plus dead from the Palestinian side, the 60 plus dead from the Israeli side. Let me be very clear about this. Every single Israeli death matters for me, just as every single Palestinian, whether Christian or Muslim, death matters to me. It is abhorrent for anybody to say that one death is more important than the other, because if we say that, I'm joining the ranks of those radicals against whom I speak all the time. However, let me also add a couple of other statistics that you didn't give out, and those aren't mine. They're UNRWA statistics, in other words, UN-based statistics. There are, at the moment, over 425,000 displaced Palestinians in Gaza as a result of the shelling. Of those, 225,000 of them are located in 86 shelters run by UNRWA and UN agencies and other NGOs. The rest are hiding or staying with friends. When you look at those numbers, and when you look at the destruction and the rubble in some parts of Gaza, when you look at the fact that people are given notice of a few minutes to vacate their homes and leave because their houses are going to be attacked, where are they going to go? In a little tiny strip like that, where neighbors are cheek by jowl, how do you expect those people to go? And if they do go, where would they go? They would go to their certain death. Now, I've spoken on many other interviews, and I put on my international law hat, and people have asked me, Harry, proportionality, what do you say? My answer to that is very simple. Under international law, as I understand it, and funnily enough, like anything else these days, international law is also subject to jurisprudence and different interpretations. But under international law, military necessity has three provisions. The first provision is distinction. The second is proportionality. The third is precaution. In other words, you have to identify your target, you have to give a proportional response, and then you have to be careful how you attack and where you attack. So given where we are, what I see happening today in Gaza is, if I overlook the whole political cockamamie story, what I would say is that it is anger against anger. It is one nationalism against another. It is one narrative against another. It's one country against the hopelessness of another strip. And if we take that further, I would say, as I've written in the piece that you have kindly posted on the website, we have to look not at the symptoms of the problem, we have to look at the core issue. And I'll leave you with just one word on the core issue: occupation.
Now, I noticed, actually, when you're talking about the article we posted on catholicnews.org.uk, the one from Epictasis, your website, you started off by saying, I am angry, which was quite interesting, quite an emotional response there. And for the very reasons we've gone and spoken about, so we don't need to go over them. Again, I don't want to sort of play devil's advocate here, but if you look at Israel, technically, yes, Gaza is a very acute situation. We can physically see the pain, the suffering, the lack of humanity about some of this response. But if you look at Israel, in a bigger sense, does it not see itself as under siege, unable to move?
Of course, it does.
To existence question.
Well, its right to existence cannot be really under question. Israel is one of the mightiest powers on the face of this earth. Its existence is not going to be threatened by a few missiles that have absolutely no radar guidance or any proper procedure to them. However, when I wrote my article, and then I wrote others after that as well, I've used two words. I'm angry, and then I said I'm livid. And then I also added, I'm deeply sad. Anger alone is not important. It's also the grief, the sadness that comes with it. And that grief and that sadness, as an Armenian, as an analyst, as a political person, as a church person, is not only anger with one side against the other. I'm angry, James, at the situation. I'm not angry only at one party against the other. Now, we can sit here until, what's the expression in English? The cows come home. Home. And try to analyze who is right and who is wrong. Let us not forget that this whole drama that is unfolding in Gaza was preceded by months upon months of negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians, so much so that U.S. Secretary Kerry gave up on it as well, because Israel was being intransigent in terms of what it wanted to achieve during those negotiations. Then we had the abductions, then we had the counter-abduction, then we had rockets coming from Gaza. All I'm saying personally is not that one side has all the truth with it and the other doesn't. What I'm saying is that we cannot allow our anger, our self-righteousness to take hold of a political situation when we have as political leaders the fate of a whole country, of a whole people in our hands. That's what I'm trying to say. And my mantra has been, over and over and over again, something that irritates a lot of Israelis, sometimes it even irritates Palestinians, when I say the answer is not through violence, the answer is through dialogue and negotiations. Cardinal Vincent Nichols just came up with a statement in which he exactly says that. Dialogue is the answer, not violence. But dialogue not for the sake of dialogue, endless dialogues. Let's not forget, this is a 60-year-old conflict. It's not a six-day conflict. It should be dialogue that leads toward a very clear result. That result would be a Palestinian state next to an Israeli state, both of them enjoying equal sovereignty, equal right, and equal security.
But isn't the issue, Harry, that even you yourself in your last article acknowledged that the two-state solution, and I can't see another solution personally, for what my humble opinion is worth, is it's actually got to the point now where that is ridiculed. So it's quite a desperate situation in terms of the politics.
Of course it is. But the reason that is happening, and if you notice, there is an edge of anger in my voice today. So I apologize to our listeners for being a bit wound up. Of course, you're absolutely right. But that is what is happening. We're frittering away the possibility of actually giving birth to this two-state solution. And one of the reasons why that is happening is because of all those settlements that this Israeli government, which is very right-wing in its attitude, and that's not all the fault of the prime minister. The prime minister would probably be to the left of some of his ministers in cabinet. The settlements are grabbing land and making the two-state solution impossible. Now, if you assume that if we continue at this rate, some people, the Shin Bet intelligence security services of Israel, other Israeli politicians, I don't want to quote Palestinians, I don't want to quote Arabs, I don't want to quote Europeans. I always, in my tweets, quote Israeli sources who say that if we continue at the rate we are not going to be able to have a two-state solution. Then We will definitely not have a one-state solution because the binational answer does not fit Israel. So what conclusion can I come to? The conclusion that I can come to is that Israel does not want a Palestinian state to be born. And if a Palestinian state is not born, we're going to continue with this war, and it's going to be episodes of peace followed by episodes of war, followed by more injustice, followed by more uncertainty for two peoples, one perhaps more than the other, because whether you like it or not, there is a weaker party and a stronger party, and we cannot deny that fact, and nobody should deny it either.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? It'll be 5 yearly wars, or approximately, something like that. Now, I want you to shoot me out of the water here if this is totally wrong. But part of me wonders, can the two-state solution not possibly be resurrected if we acknowledge the pain of the Palestinians that have been pushed out, basically? What if a line was drawn now and it was, here's your territory, here's ours? Would that not work, or is that incredibly naive?
That is not terribly naive, James, for a very simple reason. If we were to stop the war in Gaza today, and if tomorrow Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu were to pick up the phone, call the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and say, come over, Mr. President, to Jerusalem, or I'll come to Jericho, or whatever, let's open the drawer in our office, take out the papers that are there, those papers which are a mishmash of things like the Clinton parameters, like the Arab Peace Initiative, like the Geneva negotiations, some of which I had a bit of a hand in. If we take this out, the solution is there. We all know what the solution is. What we need is the will and the faith to implement and execute that solution. If we say tomorrow, yes, we're going to do it, we can do it. The problem is we do not seem to have the ability to do it. Israel constantly says Hamas doesn't want to make peace with us. It wants to destroy us. Then Abbas brings them into his bureaucratic cabinet to try and basically shut them up and mute their voices so that he can continue with his political agenda. And then they say, we don't talk with you because you've got Hamas members in your cabinet. You can't have it both ways. You can't have your cake and eat it. One way or another, peace is made between enemies, not between friends. And once we realize that that's what needs to be done, then I will be the first person to go out and speak in favor of a secure Israel, which has so much going for it. But what always deprives me and so many other people, including name upon name of Israeli Jews and Western Jews I can give you today, who say we can't really say all this because we know that there is a Palestinian people that has not yet got its self-determination.
Excellent, Harry. I really appreciated, actually, the way you put your, I thought, very even-handedly about how we view those that are suffering, those that have died. I think you've been very fair with that. And obviously, our prayers are with those that are dying on both sides of this terrible conflict.
Listen, James, I'm going to butt in, even if this is eating into our podcast. I've got friends. I've got a lot of friends in Jerusalem, across Israel, who could easily be at the receiving end of one of those stray missiles that is not intercepted by the Iron Dome technology. Surely I'm not stupid enough to sit here and say, no, this is a battle we have to fight. I do not have any eschatological desires. I don't want to die just because I want to become a martyr. All I'm saying is we need peace. And until both peoples realize that you don't always have to be full of blandishments in order to prove that you're someone's friend, but that you can speak openly and critically at times, that person is not my friend.
Well, you've certainly spoken clearly and openly, Harry. Appreciate that. Moving on to a no less depressing situation, I'm sorry to say, Mosul, North Iraq. And again, as you said in the intro exchanges between us, you know, a lot has been said. This in itself has moved on. We've got Islamic State, as they're now called, ISIS, as some refer to it still, I think. You know, we could go into the questions, what is a caliphate? What is a caliph? What's going on? We'll leave people to do a little bit of research there. We don't have to patronise people. But I do want to know that as of today, what is the situation? Are Christians dying there? Are they being told to convert, leave, or be killed? I mean, what is the clarity of the situation?
Again, I will speak, and again, I apologize to my listeners for being a bit on edge today. I will again answer you, James, statistically. Let us not go into what is a caliph and what's a caliphate and are we rolling back the decades to an Ottoman Turkish kind of rule. Nor am I going to touch upon the artificial borders that an Englishman and a Frenchman, Sykes and Picot, put together post-colonialism in the region. Let me just give you numbers. Mosul is the second largest city in Iraq after Baghdad, the capital. Mosul is in the north of Iraq, south of the Kurdish area, north of Baghdad. It is an area that, before 2003, had roughly 65,000 Christians in it. 2003, the US-led invasion of Iraq, that number of 65,000 Christians of different denominations, but largely Syrian Orthodox and Chaldean Catholic, dwindled to 30,000. So we've almost halved the number of Christians in Mosul. What happens then? Then we have this phenomenon called ISIS. And we have a new caliph there who pretends to speak in the name of all Islam. At the moment, the area or the stretch of land that ISIS or the Islamic State controls is roughly the equivalent of Jordan in the Middle East or Belgium within the European Union. In Mosul today, remember, I started with 65,000 Christians, went down to 30,000 post the US invasion of 2003. Then, 2 weeks ago, there were only 20 families left, Christians. Today, as we speak, there are only 5 Christian families left in Mosul.
Goodness.
A lot of them have run away. A lot of them have gone to places like Ain Qawa in the Kurdish sides of the border near Erbil. Some are in Hamdaniye in the Iraqi east of Mosul territory. But a lot of them have left. Why? Because when ISIS came in, ISIS said to the Christians, you have a choice. We are going to create a caliphate. We are going back to the times of the Prophet. One, you convert to Islam. If you don't convert to Islam, you pay a religious levy or a protection tax, so we protect you while you're living amongst us in Mosul.
Which is far too high for anyone to afford.
Which is far too high for many people to afford. And thirdly, and by the way, if you don't have money, gold is accepted. Thirdly, if you do not convert to Islam, if you do not pay this jizya or religious levy, the third option is you leave Mosul, and if you don't leave, you probably will be killed. These were the three options facing Christians.
So no wonder. What does that mean for the 5 families?
Well, the 5 families at the moment have still survived, are still living. What will happen to them, I don't know. But those are 5 families which probably cannot leave. But the question that is also important for our listeners to know, and our own chair of international affairs at the Bishops' Conference here, Bishop Declan Lang, has come up with a very strong statement on Mosul and Iraqi Christians. What I've discussed with Bishop Declan and what I'm sharing with you and our listeners today is something that we Christians should learn about. When we talk with zeal and with sorrow about all those Christians that have left Mosul, and incidentally, other parts of Iraq. Let me go back, interrupt that thought for 1 second. There were, when Saddam Hussein was still president of Iraq, there were roughly 1 million Christians in Iraq. Now, there are less than 300,000. You draw your own conclusions. But what I want to say about what's happening to the Iraqi Christians in Mosul is that in our zeal and sorrow to talk about them, to speak out about them, to lobby for them, to pray for them, we should not also forget that there are other minorities, the Turkmen, the Shabaks, the Yazidis, the Mandaeans, the Shiis, even the Sunnis. A majority of the Sunni community do not subscribe to this zealot, austere, Sharia-led idea that ISIS has. All these people are also paying a price. They should also be in our thoughts. Let us not, as Christians, be so insular that we only look at our own and do not see beyond our noses.
Crikey, Harry, that's very comprehensive. Now, let's finally, before I give you an opportunity to speak about three things, and just to let our listeners know, I know nothing of these three things.
No, you don't.
I'm really trusting you here. It could be anything at all.
Look, you've trusted me in the past, James, on every podcast. And friends of mine, some people you also know who listen very avidly to this podcast, have said that they really enjoy the synergy between you and me as presenter and interviewee. So until now, I've behaved. And I'm too angry to misbehave today.
Yeah, you keep keeping it down the line. Well, you know, you've talked about Lebanese divas. You've talked about Andy Murray. And you've talked about some very serious things as well. So I will await with bated breath what you're going to come up with there.
Okay.
But just finally, and I did want to add this, because we are talking Gaza, we are talking Mosul, but there's a lot that worries me about the extended MENA region, lots of it. Benghazi, reading up on that recently in Libya.
Libya is in flames.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Oil depots are burning. The airport of Tripoli, flights aren't coming in or going out. There are two clans, the Misrata and Zintan tribes, which are fighting it out between each other. And the central government, which pretty much has no army, is incapable of doing anything. And what is happening is one Western government after another is withdrawing its ambassador from Libya. A very bad state in Libya, a very, very sorrowful state for Libya.
And you told me that, you know, Syria seems to, it was everyone's lead story for a long time, but you said that, you know, there are more casualties now than there have been in a long
time. It's ridiculous, because we're so unidirectional in our attention, and now we've been so challenged because we are dealing with two stories at the same time simultaneously, Gaza and the Iraqi ISIS situation, that Libya has gone under the radar, Syria has gone under the radar. There have been more deaths in Syria in the last week or two. Almost 2,000 people have died, rather than in the times when we were constantly talking about Syria. It's almost like the Syrian regime on the one hand and the crazy Islamists on the other. I have decided that since the world is busy elsewhere, let us get on and fight out and kill some more people from the other side. It's awful.
And am I right to be very seriously concerned about the powder keg that is Lebanon?
I'm always concerned about the powder keg that is Lebanon. Lebanon is a very dear country for me, and I pray that the empty presidential seat, the deferred parliamentary elections, the instability that surrounds Lebanon somehow will not go into Lebanon itself. And the only thing I can say about Lebanon, and it applies pretty much to the region as well, is that nothing happens without some big powers deciding it to happen. And it seems to me at the moment, thankfully, those decision makers around the world have decided to safeguard, firewall, insulate Lebanon, and may it stay so, because the Lebanese have suffered years upon years of civil wars and fighting. They can afford to take a breath in the middle of this quagmire.
And we also haven't spoken about the Gulf states for a good while. We haven't spoken about Oman, Yemen, Bahrain. It's been a while.
It's all entirely your fault.
The whole region's strife?
That's a responsibility that even the whole conference of bishops cannot take as its own.
Indeed. I'll tell you what, Harry, let's give you the time for those three thoughts. Off you go.
Three thoughts to surprise you. They're not interesting. They're very interesting thoughts, sorry, but they're not light thoughts. The first one, I would like to draw our listeners' attention that this week is the first anniversary of the kidnapping of Father Paolo Dell'Olio. Father Paolo Dell'Olio is an Italian Jesuit priest who spent years and years of his life in northern Syria, where he rebuilt a monastery, Marmoussa, which became an ideal place for not only Christian conviviality, but interfaith encounters. Christians, Muslims of all backgrounds used to come, have a cup of minted tea with Father Paolo, and then go back to their own business. A wonderful man he is, somebody that some of the church hierarchy did not particularly like because he spoke his mind and he sometimes said things which needed to be said, but which were not perhaps very diplomatic and political. This is why
truths.
I loved him. Thank you very much, James. Uncomfortable truths. That's why I loved the man. And I thought he was standing there firmly with the revolution in Syria, but he wanted a revolution that would improve Syria toward a democracy, not take it back to the dark ages. So a thought for Father Paolo Dell'Olio. I don't know whether he's alive or dead, but wherever he is, my prayers at least are with him.
Well, we could ask for the intercession of St. Ignatius of Loyola. That would be quite appropriate on the feast day today.
Absolutely. Very appropriate. Good. My second thought is a prayer for all the victims in West Africa of the Ebola virus. It's threatening. It's frightening. And we're already worried that it's expanding outside the borders of West Africa. We're even worried that it might even come to our continent, Europe, although thankfully we have the health protocols that would probably protect us. However, the thought on Ebola is this. Ebola virus was discovered 40 years ago. Surely we could have found a vaccine for it. We didn't find a vaccine for it. Why? Because we're too busy spending money on military hardware and not on scientific or other researchers. And the third point is first anniversary for Paolo Dell'Olio, Ebola threat. And the third one, you know that I grew up in France.
Mm-hmm.
Today is the 100th anniversary of the death of Jean Jaurès. Jean Jaurès is a lot of things to a lot of people. We don't have the time for me to give you a biography on Jean Jaurès. All I will say that he was, in my opinion, one of the brighter philosophers of France. He died in 1914, hence the centenary today. Jean Jaurès is the author of something called La Petite République, the Small Republic. He was, amongst other things, a socialist who aligned himself with the workers and the working class of France. He's famous for that, and he made enemies because of that. And he also was somebody who was an anti-militarist. He was against military intervention. And what an appropriate thought to talk about Jean Jaurès today, or to think about him, when we have so much military conflagration that is engulfing the MENA region, our region, the region of our podcast, but also much further afield. So a word and a thought for all these three things, which I hope, James, did not in any way scandalize you.
They didn't at all. In fact, I just sat back, listened and found it interesting, which is quite a good sign, I think.
Thank you very much.
That is Dr. Harry Hagopian, our consultant on the Middle East North Africa region, top man that he is. At Harry Hagopian on Twitter, I've said it before, don't expect it to be down the line, don't expect it to be normal, don't expect it to be anything really, just check it out because there's some very insightful things on there done in Harry's characteristic fashion. Is that diplomatic enough for you?
That's very diplomatic. The word I use for my Twitter, and you know this, James, it's counterintuitive.
Very much so. Catholic... weren't expecting that, were you? Catholicnews.org.uk is the home of these Middle East analysis podcasts. Epectarsis.net if you'd like to look at Harry's stuff, and I would advise you do that over the next 3 or 4 weeks while we wait for another podcast. Thank you so much for your time. That was a packed half an hour, but hopefully an interesting one for you. Certainly was for me. And Harry, we'll see you again in the very near future.
Hopefully.